This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
And to our listeners again, good morning and welcome to this conversation. As we've indicated, that it is a virtual conference that is being held by the NLC, and the focus of this virtual conference is conflict of interest. So it's a conflict of interest conversation that we're having. And as I was saying now to Nompumelelo, just before we went to Power News, is when we speak about conflict of interest, we also need to speak about proximity. And how proximity also becomes a conflict of interest, and at which point does proximity become a conflict of interest, and at which point does proximity also become influence, because that's a major issue that we need to be dealing with as well. So our panelists this morning who will be joining us for the conversation, we have Pro Ethics, that is Dr. Jeanette Menar, who's from Pro Ethics, the founding director. We're also joined by Advocate Kevin Malunga, who is a former deputy public protector, and a part of this conversation this morning is also Dr. Solomon Wuchenrad Vermaak, who's the acting head public administration, ethics and integrity, disciplinary technical assistance. So we'll be getting our opening remarks from them, and then we start the conversation. We'll also be opening up to our guests who are here. Unfortunately, it does seem lonely because of COVID-19 and all the social distancing protocol that we have to adhere to. But unfortunately, these are difficult conversations that we need to continue, having. We'll also be taking your calls for this conversation on 0861-987-000, your tweets at Aldrin St. Pierre, hashtag PowerTalk, and also you can tweet at PowerFM987. So let's start off the conversation, getting our opening remarks from our panelists. We'll start off with Dr. Jeanette Menar. Good morning.
Good morning, Aldrin. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen and listeners. Thanks for joining us this day, and thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. From my side, as an opening remark, I would like to commend the NLC for taking this initiative in educating their staff and, of course, everyone in the public sector. Yeah. It's a wonderful opportunity for all of us to learn. We enjoy it. It's our passion. So needless to say, with COVID-19, we miss people. we therefore even all the more appreciate this opportunity, and I believe it will be a very, very fruitful day. And I want to invite everyone, ask questions, take part, make the most of this opportunity.
Okay, thank you so much. Advocate Malunga.
Thank you. Testing. Thank you very much, Aldrin.
One, two.
Thank you very much, Aldrin. And I would also like to acknowledge the chair of the National Lotteries Commission and the board, and my fellow panelists. This is something that I've been very passionate about for a very long time, and I've written on it. And but the elephant in the room, even right now, as you speak about COVID, mm-hmm. I'm sure in one of your other shows you've spoken about COVID-19 corruption.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has dealt with perceived or real conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. So this stink is not going away, as we will see. The flight to Zimbabwe was a conflict of interest between the party and state, mm-hmm. the state and government of South Africa and the ANC as a party. So this thing just keeps on rearing its ugly head. And it's a discussion, I think, I want to commend the National Lotteries Commission, you know, for grabbing the bull by the horns, mm-hmm. or the horns by the bull, whatever you want to say. But it's something that will really continue to get people into trouble if they don't confront it.
Yeah. Dr. Solomon?
Thank you, Aldrin. Good morning, Aldrin. Good morning, panelists, fellow panelists. Good morning, everyone present here, also the listeners at home. I want to commend the NLC for this very, very well-planned and good initiative. As my fellow panelists said, that we really need a conversation around conflicts of interest to understand it better, and also on a level where the people out there can understand what it is and how they also can contribute to it, and also address the situation that it does not escalate into other issues at a later stage. Because to my view, conflict of interest is the start, the root of all evil. That is where things start. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay, and thank you so much for that. So as we've indicated, we're taking your calls on 0861-987-000. Your tweets at Aldrin St. Pierre. Use the hashtag PowerTalk, and also you can tweet at PowerFM987. So, Dr. Minnar, let's start off with defining conflict of interest. And I heard Advocate Malunga also make that distinction around perceived conflict of interest and actual conflict of interest.
Well, I think a good place to start is the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that the NLC has used in its conflict of interest policy to say what is a conflict, and it's defined as follows. A conflict between, a person has a conflict of interest when you have a conflict between the public duty of that person and the private interest in which that official's private capacity interest could improperly influence the performance of their duties, their official duties on the one hand, their responsibilities, and then their private interests on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And that also creates an ethical dilemma, which I'll be speaking about a little bit later on in the presentation, not to preempt that. And perhaps my learned colleague on my side will say, what's that difference between the perceived and the real and the fundamental managed conflicts? Because they're different types of conflicts, and we need to understand the differences between those. And the one thing that I want to invite our listeners today is, don't think this is not going to affect you. Sooner or later, we all come across that crossroads mm-hmm. where we need to take the right decision. Mm-hmm. So let's find out more.
Okay, Advocate Malunga.
Okay, thank you. I think the distinction is as a doctor has indicated, you have actual, manageable, and actual fundamental.
So it is manageable.
Yeah. So actual manageable is where the perceived the conflict does not endanger, let's say, an institution's functions. Mm-hmm. Let's say, for example, the board, the chairperson of the board, let's say his cousin, his distant cousin, for example, gets a contract within the organization, right? And it is then established that, no, there is no reasonable prospect of reputational or other damage to the institution as a result of that. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes it may be so far removed that it doesn't. But then when it's fundamental, it has to be gotten rid of. And for the most part, it is usually fundamental, where for example, familial relations are concerned. The kind of facts that keep on coming up, especially in South Africa, mm-hmm. where, for example, a family member is the one who is the one who has influenced the outcome of a public procurement.
And because for me, that's the other thing, right, Advocate, is that when we speak about conflict of interest, mm-hmm. and people would ordinarily think that that means an influence. So sometimes it doesn't really mean influence, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes it actually does mean influence, that the person would have gotten the contract because of the proximity to a certain senior person or political person within the sphere.
Yeah, sometimes it's employment. Very often, in South Africa, that there are usually two avenues. It's public procurement, that's the elephant in the room, which is getting a lot of people into trouble. You're seeing this story in Gauteng over the PPEs and so forth. But then you also have a lot when it comes to employment. Mm-hmm. You know, where they say, given Mkhari,
yeah.
I know he's a friend of mine, the chairperson.
My boss?
Yes, your boss. His niece or his daughter comes in without an interview. That's a bad example because it's a private sector. Mm-hmm. Flouting all the rules of Power FM of recruitment.
Yeah.
Right. And that when that happens in the state, it's a very big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because then it's a fundamental conflict of interest. The organization wants optimal performance, right? Whereas you then want what? You want your niece or nephew to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And she may not know anything about broadcasting. Mm. She may not know anything about the function in question.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of that, municipal managers, mayors all over the country. We've had a lot. In fact, we had a very interesting one where in Limpopo, in my previous role, where there was an allegation that someone had given his mistress a chief director job of over $1 million to avoid paying maintenance. You know, so in other words, he's paying maintenance through the back door. That's a conflict of interest, hiring mm-hmm. your own mistress and so forth. So those are the kind of things that come up more and more. But it's not in every case that is so, because it may be far removed by the facts. But 90% of the time, in my own experience, it's inadvisable to have a situation where family members get contracts mm-hmm. or you hire your own family and so forth within close proximity.
Yeah,
and that's actually what is getting a lot of people into trouble in this yeah. country.
Dr. Solomon, I like another distinction that Advocate Malunga now brings in, and he makes the example of Power FM, and then he quickly says that it's a bad example because he's speaking about the private sector and how the private sector understands conflict of interest versus what the public sector understand conflict of interest to be.
Aldrin, we are lucky in the public service that we have a constitution.
Yeah.
Which is where we start. The Constitution is very clear to say that we must have a professional public service with professional public servants. Mm-hmm. So based on that, you can already deduce what you should, how you should act, what you should behave like, because that is dictated by the Constitution. So that must find its resonance in legislation, in rules, in your directives, and in your policy, and that is where the DPSA plays a role. We are the policy engine of government, mm-hmm. and we are the ones that set the norms and standards, and this is interpreted based on the Constitution. So it is the responsibility of the Minister for Public Service and Administration to set the norms and standards, mm-hmm. and it's clear what the norms and standards should be.
Mm-hmm. Do we make that distinction, because here we're speaking about public money and not necessarily private money?
Yes, exactly. And that is why, for me, we can look at the definitions of the OECD, we can look at all sorts of definitions, but
yeah.
the easiest way for me to explain a conflict of interest in the public service, mm. it's that thing that gets between you and the pay that you get at the end of the month. Mm. So if that salary does not pay for the services that you paid for, because you either went to the bank, or you did extra studies, or you phoned someone to take care of your kid. So it's not always the criminal things.
Yeah.
And that, for me, is, in short, conflict of interest. So it has two elements. It has the element of criminality, where obviously someone pay you to not do your job that you paid for.
Mm.
Or it can be that where you are at work, but you're not working. Because then you're actually also criminal, because you steal the salary.
Yeah.
Because you're not working, but you paid for that hours that you are there at work, and you don't have any product yeah. to show for that.
Okay, so 0861-987-000. You can also tweet at Aldrin St. Pierre, hashtag PowerTalk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. Dr. Manar, you wanted to add something quickly before we go to the power line?
Yeah, so in the private sector, conflict of interest is equally a problem. Because the moment I'm conflicted as an individual, I'm not no longer serving the best interests of the company or, in the public sector, the organization, the public. And an organization has a duty towards those that it's serving to be successful, to be profitable, to deliver that service. When I'm not acting in the best interest of that organization, that company, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and I'm getting paid for that job.
But I find it interesting that when it comes to private companies, for instance, a private company, the CEO could, the CEO's son could be hired, for instance, and work for the company, and the argument would be that this person knows can deliver the service. And if you make your own assessment and you can tell that actually this person can deliver the service, it almost then means that there's no conflict of interest. However, though, in the public sector, it becomes different. It becomes a fuel.
So if I can, I'd like you to answer on the public sector one. Right? And the private sector, remember, the moment, if I have a tiny little company and I appoint my son and he doesn't have the qualifications, so he's not doing us any good, those losses are coming to my pocket. So I'm going to feel it. Mm-hmm. But the moment I go to a bigger private company, let's say I'm a big bank, and now I appoint a senior official, private sector, who's not doing what he or she is doing, it affects all the staff and those that it's serving. So in the private sector, it's not that easy to just make it off. Mm. If there are proper procurement procedures, like most big companies do, my clients do, I still have to follow them, whether I'm the CEO and the founding director or not.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, it's also my duty to serve the best interests of that company, that organization. So whoever I choose to appoint should have been chosen by someone objective, independent. Mm-hmm. And the moment those two duties for me to be objective and independent is harmed in any way because I'm conflicted, I am now acting contrary to my formal duties, even as a private sector person.
Okay, so let's just quickly go to the power line on 0861 987 000. Timothy, good morning. Hi, good morning, Timothy. Can you hear us? Okay, Timothy, are you there? Okay, we don't seem to have Timothy on the line. So, but the question that he wanted to ask is around, is it still considered conflict of interest after a person has declared?
It depends on whether it's fundamental or not. So in other words, the mere declaring of a conflict doesn't make it good enough. So I take the gift policy or the conflict of interest policy and I write down, received one white BMW from so-and-so supplier. That's not good enough. There are certain rules and guidelines about that because I cannot defend my position to say, despite having received this car, I'm still objective and independent. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. So the only way for me to is either there's a good guideline about that, I'm not allowed to receive that at all, I'm not allowed to influence a decision, for example, of the HR committee in who to appoint, or the procurement point, committee, and I have to recuse myself entirely from the process. Mm-hmm. So mere declaration in itself is a first step. But that's not where it ends.
Okay.
You'll recall there was an example a few years ago. Former Minister Sbundebele received a massive S-Class Mercedes Benz worth over 1.5 million and I think some cattle from service providers who had worked for his department. He declared that, but that was widely condemned as an improper gift. So I think there's this perception by a lot of people, and I think public officials in South Africa are getting away with it, especially members of parliament, with a lot of this declaration business of improper gifts.
Yeah. Actually, I thought that you're going to make the example of the former head of the IEC in the Ebland matter. Because in the Ebland matter as well, with advocate Pensi Tlakula, there was what the public protector at the time, Thuli Madonsela, called perceived conflict of interest, which could have been avoided. Advocate Malunga?
Yes, that was. I was still there at the time.
Yes.
And those are the kind of, very often the stink, as I would like to call it, that comes from these conflict of interest scenarios does more harm sometimes than the actual, you know. So for example, if you look, remember Dina Pule's issue with her significant
the
other.
The red bottom shoes. The red bottom shoes.
Yes.
It's the other one. Oh, the red bottom shoes.
Yes, it is. Okay. It is. But then, you know, there were both actual and perceived conflicts of interest there. Hmm. So what then happens with those scenarios is that where a department wants optimal performance, when you give the work to someone who is a lover, a friend, or whatever, you are not getting bang for buck, bang for the state's buck.
But what happens if the person can actually provide the service, Dr. Simon?
If a person...
And is actually qualified to provide the service. However, though, they know that they have to go a certain route to get the contract.
You are putting your finger on the pulse here. Because conflicts of interest usually impacts on your service delivery.
Yeah.
If a person is qualified and he got the position in a fair and open, transparent way, that is okay. That is because the values that the government live up to is openness, fairness, transparency in terms of the constitution. So if you appoint a person, you must live that values. Mm-hmm. But if a person is competent enough and the person did not go through the process, then that's a flawed process because you exclude certain persons to partake in the opportunity to be employed, to also share their knowledge. And maybe you are very sophisticated, trained, eloquent, whatever, but maybe there's someone better and that person was not tested. And that's why it's wrong, fundamentally wrong to do that.
Okay. Sipo, let's go back to the power line on 061-987-000. Let's see if it works now. Sipo, good morning.
My question specifically goes to Advocate Melunga. There is a school of thought that says that, the current malfeasance that we're experiencing on the procurement space started with the nature of the transaction in 1994, whereby people just celebrated the fact that politically they are empowered, but economically not. And the second one is that what kind of measures can you really try to come up with to deal with issues of transgression beyond arrest and take them to prison? I mean, in terms of morality and ethics and everything, what is it that we can do to actually say to our people in state-owned enterprises and those who are, heads of these departments and everything, to ensure that they don't really take advantage of the loopholes and everything, because of, based on my observation, it is going to be very difficult that we can create a kind of like a pure, procurement, space.
Okay, Sipo, I just need you to quickly repeat the first part of your question.
The first part of my question is that there is a school of thought that says that The current corruption has its roots in the nature of our transition in 1994, whereby blacks only, get excited with acquiring the political power, and they were never economically empowered. The nature of the Codesa negotiations themselves, which left, the largest part of the economy on the hands of whites. And as a result, black people who became billionaires and everything as a result of acquiring shares into already white existing, companies without any skills or whatsoever.
Thank you so much for that, Sipo. We got the gist of it as well. So we're going to get Advocate Malunga to respond to that. And then after Power News Headlines, we'll get our other panelists to respond to that as well. And remember that you can be part of the conversation by calling on 0861-987-000. And I say we open this up to the staff members of the NLC as well. Call 0861-987-000 and Sina Temba will be answering your call on the other side. And you can also tweet at Aldrin Simpier. Advocate Malunga?
Thank you. Sipo, yes. The issue of economic empowerment, my understanding obviously is that there are triple BEE laws and they have actually tried to deal with that. And even Section 217 of the Constitution that deals with procurement says it must be open, transparent, and take into account the previous dispensation. Mm-hmm. In other words, so by its very nature, public procurement in the country is, you know, considerate of the fact that there is that, which is why generally white-owned companies are not necessarily at the end, back of the line, but they have to have a certain BE compliance, yes, etc. It's in that spirit. So my sense is that there is that consideration. Where the problem is, in my own experience working in this space, is the culture of something for nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, where people want to take from the state without providing quality services. And this is not necessarily a black and white issue. Corruption, yeah, is black and white, yeah, and green and whatever.
And I guess
by far, a lot of these companies that get these contracts, sure, have a habit of doing that.
Okay, we just need to go to Power News Headlines quickly. And we're just listening to you, Advocate. You think about the Competition Commission, for instance, and how many times the Competition Commission comes out with judgments that tells you about how prices have been inflated. And even now, during COVID-19, look at some of the services that have been provided through the tender process, where a plastic bag, which costs 70-something, something cents shoots all the way up to about 4 rand or something ridiculous like that.
Your way.
Power Talk with Aldrin Sampier. Weekdays, 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
And you're still listening to Power Talk with me, Aldrin Sampier. We're coming live from Melrose Arch, where the NLC is hosting a conversation around conflict of interest. And we have three panelists focusing on this particular question, as well as the comments that you have and the input that you want to make to this conversation as well. You can do that on 0861-987-000. Your tweets at Aldrin Sampier, and you can also tweet at PowerFM 987. So coming up on the show between 11 and 11.30, we will be in conversation with the German embassy, also focusing on the cultural exchange program that the Germans have between the Germans as well as South Africa. So that will be between 11 and 11.30. And then at 11.30, we will be in conversation with the statistician general, focusing on the question around the expanded definition of unemployment. And yesterday, you may have seen the unemployment rate that came up that said that the unemployment rate has decreased to 23.3%, while at the same time, the number of unemployed people has increased by 2.2 million. So we'll have Rusenga Maluleka for that conversation to explain South Africa's stance with regards to this. But focusing on the conversation that we have right now is on the conflict of interest. And Dr. Solomon, just quickly want to go back to the call that we received earlier on and the question around when it comes to consequence management, and the caller speaks about not only arrest. I don't know what else there could be.
In terms of the DPSA, we do not have a mandate to arrest or to investigate. And that is one thing that people sometimes do not understand, that they expect the DPSA to get some people in orange jumpsuits, which it's definitely not our speciality or our mandate. What we do is we set the norms and standards. It's like going to a party. Before you go to the party, you want to know what to wear. Mm-hmm. What will the occasion be? So we set the scene. We say this is the norms. We all go with denims or we all go with suits. But then you can't come up with your own clothing style and attend the party. So we set the norms and the standards to say clearly this is what is expected of you. But then if you do breach that, there's different approaches that one can employ. In the previous comment, I said that sometimes conflict of interest is about ethics and sometimes it's about the law, if it's right or if it's wrong. So legal speaking, it's very easy. You take a person through the disciplinary process and that's it. But then in the grey areas, one also needs to make room in your organisation to talk to people, to explain to them why and to take them through...
What do you mean by grey areas?
That is the ethics areas
where
sometimes it's not that clear. If you show a block with nine blocks in it and you ask people, what do you see? Most people will say nine blocks. Mm-hmm. But then some people will count the outside and come up with creative ways to look at the block as well. Mm. And that's not wrong. Mm. And that's the same with norms and standards and ethics. Everyone see in it what they want. So it's your duty... And especially in the departments, these ethics officers, to then explain to them, there may be more blocks, but don't see them. Just look at the nine.
Yeah.
Because that is what... And then you take them through an awareness program. And I found myself that if you explain to a person the impact of it, especially a public servant, because you are there to serve, if you explain the impact of your actions... then you get change in behavior. Mm-hmm. So it can't always be you take the baton and you hit a person. Mm-hmm. You must also explain and engage.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to ask Mayor Charlotte Mambani, who is an NLC commissioner, to just quickly take one of the mics and also answer this particular question with regards to how the NLC handles the issue around conflict of interest, because which is quite important. But Mayor Mambani as well, can you also touch on the issue of proximity and how we should understand proximity and when does proximity become conflict of interest?
Thank you, Alton, and thank you to the listeners. Sure, it's so tense in this room. Is it because You know, I've just named the gentleman Dr. Mampane because his surname is too long. So, Aldrin, you'll be little Mampane as well. Yes, if we can just lighten up a bit, though we are discussing a very serious issue. Yes, I will come back to the two questions you asked me. But I thought I should just mention something. I think the panel really is saying such a lot of good things, you know. I got tired of taking those copious notes. But here's the challenge I have, especially when we look at the NLC situation. You got to ask questions around what's happening in the public sector, what's happening in the private sector. In South Africa, in most cases, we forget the third sector, which is civil society. And that's where the NLC is basically operating. And that's where actually we seem to be confronted with a lot of challenges. Let me just cite an example. You got to talk about, for instance, how somebody would employ a family member and whatever. With civil society, when those people register NPOs and NGOs, they don't have many people that they are thinking about. It's about Ntate Mampane. It's about baby Mampane, Aldrin. It's about Auntie Mampane, doctor there. You understand? So we are confronted with that most of the time. You end up with a situation where the whole entity that you have to fund is made up of family. So those are the challenges that are confronting us. And as if that is not enough, for me, as somebody said earlier on, conflict of interest is there. We are parents with both Prof, with both Dr. Matsi Vandela. We have children. We have family.
Yeah.
And just think of the challenge of having to manage all the family members that, look, Mampane is at the NLC, so as a result, you don't have to apply for funding, you don't have to do this and that, and you spoke about proximity as well. Taking the years that a person would have been involved in different organizations, it's about how then you deal with issues where somebody who knows Mampane Mutibi comes and says, hey, you remember, we went to school together.
Yeah.
And how do you now help me to access funding? So, look, the important thing, it's about how we develop frameworks in organizations and learn to manage it.
Yeah.
But I can't say we are doing that perfectly. Here we are as the NLC, we are being accused of that from time to time. So for me, the challenge is about what is it that is so solid that you need to put in place to make sure that you manage that conflict in terms of one, proximity.
Yeah.
Because it has to be done. And many a times I get to declare to our company secretary and to our professor. But then I forget, I go to church as well, and I'm a mama of Manyano, and all these mamas will come and talk to me. So it's not like you will, I'm sorry, be declaring all the time. But as a principle, I think it is important for us to set out rules, not policies only, and love those rules about how we manage conflict of interest.
Yeah.
At the NLC, for instance, the act that governs us says, long as you have something to do with the NLC, you will not be involved, or you will not have anybody close to you, friends or whatever, actually doing business with the NLC. It is about how we take that and entrench it in the organization.
Okay.
So I answered one question. Your second question?
No, you've dealt with that, and that's how the NLC is dealing internally with the issue around conflict of interest. But just a quick follow-up question, and then I'll ask Dr. Menar to respond to that as well, is that if, for instance, Umama Wemanan and you don't know ukuthi ubaba umfundisi went to the NLC to go and apply for funding, and then the NLC then grants ubaba umfundisi the funding. And then all of a sudden, at a later stage, after the investigation, we find out that actually the Methodist that you go to is the same Methodist that has now benefited from funding from the NLC. How then do you deal with that? Because now this is now after the effect.
It's about after the effect.
Yeah.
And yes, it's about how you have to declare upfront. As soon as you become aware, in the policy, there's also room that as soon as you become aware, within 7 days, you have to declare.
Mm-hmm.
But here's my issue. Is declaration enough?
Yeah.
Because I want to believe that we have a situation where a person will say, I declared. Where I will say, when 7 days came, I declared. But how does that get managed thereafter? You mentioned the parliamentarians, for instance, that they get to declare. Is declaration enough? What needs to happen even after declaration?
Okay.
Thank you.
Dr. Minar?
Yeah, thank you so much, Commissioner. Those were your valuable contributions. Mm-hmm. So the first thing, what about reputation? The NLC, as you correctly said, Madam, is that you're dealing with civil society, with those that need the money, the grants, the most. So we need to protect them from the NLC's part, and we need to manage our reputation. Hence the importance for all our employees to recuse themselves entirely. So once I've declared, if it is a fundamental conflict of interest, something that it's impossible for me to exercise my professional judgment, I must remove myself from that decision, from that contract management, from dealing with that supplier, whatever it may be. In that case, we've done the most that we possibly could. So there are three measures that we can use. We abide by the law. The law says it's illegal to accept a bribe in return for doing something for you. It's illegal. So that's the first thing we want to avoid at all costs. It's dishonest. It harms our reputation. The second is the NLC has terrific policies and rules. Very specific rules. If there's a perceived conflict of interest, I need to declare it, and there needs to be an investigation. You will investigate. The commissioner will get back to say, Yannette, you may continue. There's a real reality that this will not happen. You're fine. Thanks for letting us know. This can be managed. And then the third element is ethics. Now, I can't see what you're thinking. I can't see what's in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that test is a personal test, isn't it? For each of us individually. To say, I'm 100% convinced, I've applied my mind carefully, I'm intellectually honest to myself and to others, that I'm not conflicted.
Mm-hmm.
I can exercise my duties fully to the best interest of my employer, in this case, the NLC. So the three legs, the law, I cannot violate the law. Second, I have to abide by the rules of my employer. And if the employer says, wear your safety gear when you're in the mine, I can't say, but the color doesn't suit my skin tone.
Mm-hmm.
I have to abide by the rule. It's part of my conditions of service.
Yeah.
And then the third one, at all times, I have to abide by the values of the public sector, and of course, the very well-declared and explained values of the NLC.
Okay, I think this also speaks to what Carol wants to ask. Good morning, Carol.
And thanks for the opportunity. I suppose, in a way, the lady touched what I wanted to ask, to say, how does the National Lottery Commission deal with conflict of interest in tenants, the institution itself? For example, we know there are huge ones that are supposed to be dispersed or accessed by the NGO sector around the country. The huge challenge is that the lottery employees themselves, they want a cut from the very fund. Obviously, they wouldn't do it before, they would do it after. If the NGO doesn't promise them a certain percentage, the money they don't get. And maybe should ask, are they aware of such? And have they investigated what is the process? And what I want to know, what are the checks and balances in place to really check who are those trying to steal the money from the community? And is it a conflict of interest and fraud, and maybe from the other panelists as well? when does the line get crossed between fraud and conflict of interest? Because this actually is really stemming from the poorest of the poorest, from the national lottery itself.
Thank you so much for that, Carol. So we'll get the panelists to respond to that. We also have Nompumelelo Nene, who is the company secretary, and she'll respond to some of those questions that you have there just after this.
Join me, Dumisang Zovu, tonight on the Power Boardroom segment of Power Business for an in-depth and dynamic conversation about corporate South Africa. I will be joined by a panel of guests to dissect a key business topic of the day. Power Boardroom is proudly brought to you by Nedbank Business. Search Nedbank Bigger Picture Business Banking. Nedbank, see money differently.
With DStv Rewards, you get rewarded just for being part of the DStv family, which means you get rewarded for never missing a moment of. You get rewarded for kicking back with the hottest movies on box office. And for streaming your favorite local series on Showmax.
What a joke, my darling.
No jokes, my darling. Just great rewards. And that's... Masters. Join DStv Rewards for free on the MyDStv app. It's too easy. T's and C's apply.
Have you ever felt that you've been treated unfairly in matters of finance? This week, with the Asisa Foundation's Save Our Wire Wire Wage Wise campaign, we are going to be discussing consumer rights. So you can tune in to Power Talk this Thursday at 11:30, where I'll be joined by a financial expert to discuss your rights as a consumer and what you can do if you have a complaint with your financial services company. And don't forget, we're giving away 1,500 rand. Yes, because we can.
Power Talk with Eldrin Sampier, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
Okay, to that question that that was asked earlier on by Carol.
Thank you, Carol, for your question. The NLC has a fully fledged and well-resourced ethics office. We are supported by the stewardship of the board, who are committed to ethical leadership, as well as we are an independent office. So firstly, our staff have maintained over the past 4 years that the ethics office has been under the company secretariat custodianship, 100% compliance in terms of their disclosures. Those disclosures annually are vetted. We have an electronic system which is linked to our CIPC database. More recently, we have now started checking against the Department of Social Development for any conflicts within the NPO sector and if they link back to our staff members. We also, from a procurement side, now looking at the CSD database so that we ensure that our staff are compliant. Our ethics office is not a police service, so ours is to assist our employees identify any areas of conflict if there's potential or perceived before they become actual conflict and fundamental. Where there's a fundamental conflict of interest or perceived, as you've seen in the newspapers, there are internal controls within the NLC where from the commissioner level to the board, investigations are instituted to test whether this conflict that is perceived is actual or actual manageable or actual fundamental, which then can lead to corruption. We also have a fully fledged forensic unit under our legal division where anybody who suspects or sees any wrongdoing are free to call this independent line, independently managed, to whistleblow. We also, as the ethics office, receive complaints and we work in collaboration with our legal unit together with our human capital. So there are very strong internal controls to identify areas of conflict within our staff members. A staff complement of 300, I can safely say we are not corrupt. Our staff aren't there to steal the public purse. And we have a very dedicated staff who are understanding now through the efforts of various divisions what is conflict of interest. Hence, we've taken this conversation to say, let us also learn from other entities, from past practice and observations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much for that. And Dr. Solomon, just a quick one on the point that was raised around the lines between conflict of interest and fraud, because sometimes it's quite easy to see what conflict of interest is because of the relationship in terms of the proximity and so forth. But at times, Nompumelelo would have to wait for a complaint to be laid before even knowing that money has actually been paid to an NLC staff member who has benefited from a organization that got money from the NLC.
That's why I indicated that a conflict of interest is, for me, the root of all evil, because it's not something that's so clear-cut.
Yeah.
It sometimes starts out as unethical conduct, where a person pays you a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way you work. And then for that, when you see that person, you do a bit extra for the person because the person is nice. Later on, the person brings you something to make sure that you remain nice.
Mm. Yes.
And that is where you blur the lines then.
Yeah.
Where you overstep the boundaries because this person now is paying you. It's no longer from your own...
Yeah.
That you want to actually make a change. So it's not that clear cut, but mm-hmm. the moment that you do something that's illegal, then you know,
yeah.
because that is clear in the law.
Because the State Capture Commission of Inquiry, Advocate Malunga, dealt with this particular question yesterday as well, where Advocate Pretorius was asking one of the gentlemen who was part of the company that was dealing with the asbestos, removing the asbestos in the Free State. And his argument, this is now the businessman's argument, was that there's absolutely nothing wrong with me donating money to an organization, being the governing party, which I believe in. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The law doesn't say there's anything wrong with that. However, what Advocate Pretorius then points out is that it would seem, though, that the money comes from a certain community. So once that money is then dispersed to your company, that money then also comes back to the community, or a portion of that money goes back to the community. And here he's speaking about certain politicians as a community.
Thanks. Yeah, that is, you see, the issue that is at stake here is that we're talking about, there's nothing wrong with proper use of power.
Yeah.
Right? Or authority. So now, in this case, we are talking about misuse or abuse of authority.
Mm-hmm.
So you have those functionaries, and I don't want to preempt the
yeah.
findings of the commission, but you have people who have authority to grant contracts and tenders and so forth. And the particular function of those contracts and tenders is to deliver services to the people of Free State,
mm-hmm.
the best services, right? Now, when you have these particular individuals in question, their particular motivation is to get as much money for as little as possible from that particular entity.
Mm-hmm.
So that hence the term conflict.
Mm-hmm.
of interest.
Mm-hmm.
So the interests are conflicting. Their private interests are now conflicting with the public
yeah.
obligations.
But when do the donations, for that matter, even become influence? Form of influencing decision-making?
The problem comes in is that the more that particular person is if Audrey Sampier is now the go-to guy,
yeah,
Audrey Sampier will always get contracts. Even if he doesn't know what he's doing,
mm-hmm.
you see. So there's then manipulation of public procurement in favor of those particular individuals who usually, and in my own experience, charge exorbitant amounts, millions, hundreds of millions for things that can be done for next to nothing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of this conversation here on Power Talk. However, the panel conversation will continue here at Melrose Arch. And just listening to Advocate Malung, I remember former President Thabo Mbeki appearing before the Commission of Inquiry into the arms deal. And one of the questions was asked about the money that was paid to certain individuals who were the middlemen, you know. And he said that, well, it could be commission. And that's another difficult one. When does commission become a bribe? Anyway, we're done with that one. But you guys can continue with this conversation just after this.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.